JSA in the 90s. This episode, Justice Society of America number 5, cover dated August 1991. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but guess what? I have brought along a friend. In fact, each episode, I invite a different guest to help me tackle an issue of the JSA. My co-host today is an old buddy of mine, going all the way back to my blogging days. We started working on projects together something like 18 years ago. He also happens to be a sucker for lost cases. This guy's favorite characters include, check this out, you ready? Red Tornado, Cyborg, Doom Patrol, Dead Man, Firestorm, and relevant to this episode, Hawkman. That's a whole lot of canceled series between them. He is a true glutton for punishment. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Doug Zavisha. Welcome to the JSA Brownstone, Doug. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Thanks for having me, Shag. I'm doing great. I'm better now, or as a friend of mine likes to say, if I was any better, I'd be twins.
Well, I'm excited to have you here. We have done lots of projects together, whether it was blogging or podcasting or just eating pizza together. We have done several things together, and you're a perfect fit for this episode, really, because I know you're a big fan of Mike Parabek, as many of us are.
Yes.
In fact, you asked to do a Mike Parabek issue. That's how we got you here. And one of the main heroes in this issue is Hawkman, and you kind of have a little bit of connection to Hawkman, I think. Isn't that right?
Kind of little, maybe a little something called the Hawkman Companion from Tomorrow's. We're not going to talk about when that was published, but that got me working with Tomorrow's a little bit. And actually, I did have a follow-up in back issue, not as long ago as the book was originally published, but you can get your back issue sales and check that one out. And I do think they've got one coming up with Hawk Girl, so there might be something there.
Okay. Something maybe we should be looking for?
Maybe.
Okay. Very cool. Yeah, Doug was the Hawkman expert back in the days. Like, whenever we were doing anything in the blogging world, we had questions on Hawkman. We'd either ask you or Luke Giaconetti, who was running the Hawkman blog at the time. And you guys were our experts. And as you pointed out in our pre-conversation, this was published quite a while ago. And you made me feel exceptionally old. So thank you for that, Doug.
Sorry about that, Shag. But you don't have to feel old because we haven't been aging at all. Just kind of like the JSAers back in, I don't know which issue that was, or which run of JSA that was, but they didn't get any older, right?
Right.
Thanks to Ian Kirkhole, we got the same magic, right?
Except it didn't save our hair for some reason.
I think the hair for me was a lost cause before any of that. So
yeah.
All good.
I started receding at 12. So anyway. Before we make this a Hair Club for Men ad, why don't we take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, every episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library, and usually to be tied into this month's JSA issue in some way, shape, or form. Mine's a bit of a stretch this time, but since this issue features a team-up of two heroes, I picked Brave and the Bold Trade Paperback Volume 1, Lords of Luck. It's the 2024 edition, because the title needed to be longer. What this is, folks, this is the Mark Waid and George Perez run of Brave and the Bold from 2007. That's the easier way to put it. It's the first six issues. You guys know it. Again, written by Waid, drawn by Perez. I shouldn't even have to say anything else, but it features great team-ups every single issue. It does have a continuing thread, so each issue builds on the next. It is a super fun story. It's 160 pages, full color, soft cover, normally goes for $17.99, but you can get it for 40% off, so it's only $10.79 for a great six-issue story from Brave and the Bold. I love this one.
I got to tell you, Shag, when I saw that in the notes, I started grinning ear to ear because I had just pulled that out this summer.
Oh.
In there, among the other stories, is a Supergirl-Lobo team-up, which may have had some seed for the Supergirl-Lobo team-up within the Supergirl movie this summer. So
I didn't even think about that. That's a good point.
Yeah. Right there, look at you being all timely.
yeah, that was all me.
Well planned.
Well, Doug, did you happen to bring a pick to talk about?
I did. Mine is more Golden Age inspired.
Okay.
It's Adventure Man, The End and Everything After. And what I'm suggesting here is either the trade paperback of Volume 1 or the hardcover. In Stock Trades has the trade paperback at $8.05, which is normally priced at $12.99, saving you 38%. Or you can get the hardcover, which is a European-sized edition, and it's regularly priced $24.99, listed at $15.49, again, saving you 38%. But the long and the short of it is, written by Matt Fraction, drawn by Terry Dodson with Rachel Dodson. Clayton Coles is there for lettering, and it is just absolutely fun. It's what comics are all about, and it doesn't feel unlike something that Mike Parabek might be doing now if he were still around, but it's Terry Dodson. And Terry Dodson's kind of in that middle space between, maybe on the Venn diagram between Adam Hughes and Mike Parabek, right? Mm-hmm. He's good with the good girl stuff, and he's also good with the heroic stuff without making either one really look too cheesy. But the story is a nice little Doc Savage homage, but it's through the lens of a different character who's picking things up from an adventure that maybe went wrong. And we learn more as the story goes on, and the art alone is worth price.
You had me at Matt Fraction and Terry Dodson. Oh my gosh. Wow. I've never even heard of this thing. This sounds fantastic. A Doc Savage, Golden Age homage kind of story with those creators. 200 pages for that price? That's crazy. This sounds wonderful.
Well, and here's the best part about it, because you got that deal with In-Stock Trades where you order over $50, you get free shipping. So me and a couple buddies decided to start our own book club around Adventure Man. I ordered up 3 copies, and I got free shipping for all of us. So.
Oh, boom. There you go.
There you go.
That's fantastic. Wow. Well, that's a great pick. So it's Adventure Man, The End and Everything After, trade paperback. All right. Well, I'm going to have to check that out. Thanks for the tip, man.
Absolutely.
Folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcasts. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. In a certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on the show of your choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks to our all-star squadron of supporters, Al the Comics Guy, Alex Osias, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, Craig Fletcher, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, George Van Note, Gore Tolton, Jason Keane, Jeffrey Owens, Jordan Jennings, Keith G. Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Atchison, Mike Zemkowski, Roger Preeb, Little Russell Burbage, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, and Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. Now, folks, I need you guys to be part of the conversation, okay? I want you to find us on social media as JSA Presents. Give us your thoughts on this issue. Let's talk about Hawkman. Let's talk about Flash. Let's talk about Vandal Savage. Let's talk about Mike Parabek. Let's talk about whatever we want to talk about with this issue, but I need to hear from you. Again, social media, or leave your comments on our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. Go to the show post, leave your thoughts there, and I'll read them in our feedback section at the end of the show. Now, Doug, this is your chance, man. This is your moment to shine. What is your personal origin story with the JSA? How'd you find the team? What made you fall in love with them?
Oh, man. So I started collecting comic books with my own allowance around Justice League of America number 191. And it was whatever the convenience store happened to have. And I remember seeing Justice League of America number 195 with that cover by George Perez with the Injustice Gang and Killer Frost X-ing characters out, right? And it was that crossover between the JSA and the JLA. And I bought something else with my allowance at the convenience store that week and went back the next week and it was gone.
You fool!
So I never got around to it. But my real get to know the Justice Society came with Crisis on Infinite Earths. That's how I really got to learn more about Earth 1 and Earth 2 and the difference between the two teams. And okay, now I understand why this Hawkman's wearing a sock on his head and other things like that. And Crisis number 5 was one of the first comic books I ever purchased at a comic shop. It had that beautiful George Perez cover with, it was kind of split down the middle with Earth 1 faces floating on the left-hand side and there's two on the right-hand side.
Oh, yeah.
Where there was some overlap, the two faces would come together. And on the inside, I immediately fell in love with Ted Grant Wildcat because he got severely injured in a very heroic act, rescuing a young girl that he knew nothing about. When I read issue 6 and was properly introduced to the concept of the DC legacy as Yolanda Montez was picking up the Wildcat mantle while Ted was convalescing, well, I was hooked. And Wildcat became one of those aforementioned lost causes up at the top there.
That's fantastic. Wow. I mean, so many of us dove in the deep end with Crisis. It wasn't my first DC comic because I was already reading Firestorm, but it was my first introduction to the broader DC universe. And I started with issue 8. So just jumping in the middle. I specifically sought it out because I had heard The Flash died. It's a longer story that actually told on the monitor tapes, if you want to check that out. So on the monitor tapes, I told this whole story. It's pretty funny. But I jumped in with 8, then immediately bought 6. And then just sporadically caught up. And it just, back when we were kids, it was just fine to jump in the middle of a story that complicated. It was okay to do that because we held on by our fingertips and by golly, we were going to figure it out.
Yep. Yeah. And it would come around eventually, right?
Yep.
Or we'd just forget about it.
Right. But I love that the Wildcat legacy is what made you fall in love with the Justice Society, because that's what they become all about in the 2000s. It's all about the legacy. And that's a great way to sort of discover the team and, you know, make a connection. I love it.
Yeah, and actually, I'm going to digress for a little bit here, Shag. My dream of being a comic book artist, my actual first story that I drew and took to a Comic-Con in 1991 was the two Wildcats and Ted Grant pulling his costume out of retirement because Yolanda had gotten the short end of the stick in a fight. And so she was convalescing and Ted was returning to glory. And it was drawn like absolute garbage on a paper napkin. But nonetheless, that was my focus, was Ted and Yolanda again.
That's so cool. And by the way, don't be crazy. You're a very good artist. In fact, you gave me a Blue Devil card not too long ago. You're a very good artist, sir. Don't be taking shots at yourself. I will not have that.
I'll take that compliment now, but 1990, Doug, not so much.
Okay, fair enough. We've all grown a bit since then, I suppose. Yep. So in the world's worst transition, let's move over into our discussion topic for this episode. So one of the things we thought would be fun is that in this issue, Carter Hall, he is assisted by a friend of his named Will Wildeagle. And he's a fellow archaeologist with no superpowers, but he sees some heroes in trouble and he tries to help. So we thought it would be fun for the discussion topic this episode to name some other favorite non-powered allies of superheroes, specifically like the non-powered allies of the JSA or their legacies. So we're each going to name 5 non-powered allies of JSA members. So, I mean, sure, there's obvious ones we could say, like, you know, Lois Lane to Earth 2 Superman, Alfred Pennyworth to Batman, and Etta Candy to Wonder Woman. We're going to try and go a little less obvious, though. So, and folks, you guys can play along at home. You know, go to our comment section on our website and share with us your favorite people that are connected to the JSA in some way. And by the way, I should mention, we're expanding it. It's not just people that were in the JSA. It could be any legacies as well. So, like, yeah. Ted Knight, sure. But you know what? Also, all the legacy, Sylvester Pemberton, Will Payton, Jack Knight, Courtney Whitmore, Thom Kalor, Prince Gavin, you know, anyone who's connected to the Starman legacy is eligible. Same thing for any other legacy character. So why don't you go first? You go through your list.
All right. So I'm going to start off with, okay, so Will Wildeagle, he doesn't have a deep bench of appearances there. And to me, feels like an homage or a nod or a carbon copy or all of the above of Wyatt Wingfoot from the Fantastic Four's supporting cast, but through a Golden Age DC lens. So that's my first non-powered hero with that JSA connection. And it may not see it, but if you squint real hard, you can see Wyatt Wingfoot being connected.
You're totally right.
Yeah.
And by the way, as the Hawkman expert, I got to ask, Will Wildeagle, do we see him before the series or after the series ever again?
Not that I could find any record of, which is an actual shame, because why not?
Right.
You know, why not have him turn up as the friend of Carter Hall, who's hosting some, you know, traveling show of Tutankhamun's golden garbage or whatever the case may be, just to put him in a different location or to give him a different spin. And then that way Carter's not having to balance both and can focus on being that hero. Right.
Yeah. Agreed. So
it's just waiting out there, kind of like Hawkman, waiting for the right person to pick both up and run.
Yep, I agree. Who you got next?
All right. So I'm changing one up, Shag, because I know we had some notes, and this one had my original had no connection to the JSA. So I'm substituting what I had there, and we can talk about it in comments later on the site. But I'm going to put in Treya, Red Tornado's adoptive daughter.
That's good.
Yeah, right. And kind of a deep cut that everyone had forgotten about until you just heard the name mentioned right now.
You're exactly right.
she's connected all the way through Young Justice. So she's got to be there. She wasn't the bratty Cousin Oliver that she could have been, but she wasn't a character everyone dearly loved either. But she did have presence, and she kind of gave a human edge, or at least the reason for a human edge for everyone's favorite android.
That's fantastic. I haven't thought of her probably since the last time I read a Bronze Age JLA comic where she showed up, actually.
I've actually been putting off rereading the Kurt Busiek Carmine Infantino Red Tornado mini from, what was that, 83 or 84, 85, whenever that was. Because I just want to see how the construct holds up now in this age of AI.
Should be interesting.
Yeah. I'll be sure to post about it on my Red Tornado blog when I get going.
Old Thune or something like that, wasn't it?
Something like that.
He legitimately had a Red Tornado blog, folks. He's not kidding.
with all of three readers.
I was one.
And next up on my list is Mavis Trent, most notably in The Shadow War of Hawkman, where she idiotically puts on Hawk Woman's outfit and pays the price. I'm not going to spoil a 40-year-old story, but by paying the price, let's just say that the trouble she caused by sticking her nose into business she should have and couldn't have left alone, well, wasn't good for her. And I'm just going to end that with yeesh.
I've actually never read The Shadow War of Hawkman. So
it should have ended there, but it was so good.
Okay. All right. I've heard that. I heard someone else recently bragging on that miniseries.
Yeah. It deserves a collection of some degree. And I know you've done some collected editions yourself, like custom collections. So my Shadow War is sitting over to the side for a someday type of thing.
Nice.
Yeah. Next up, Linda Park West, Wally West's better half. That's pretty much all I need to say about her. If y'all have read a Wally West comic ever, you know how important Linda is to him. And for me, Wally West is probably one of the most important characters in my personal comics reading history. I've got a George Perez commission from somewhere in the early 2000s of Wally. And specifically, Linda is just, she's that much more important, or that big a facet of Wally, that if I would have had a second commission done, I probably would have had George Perez draw Linda. So that's number four on my list, which actually, I guess if we're going backwards, number two, right?
You're not going to get any arguments out of me. I mean, Linda, Wally West is my Flash. His run, especially like from Mark Waid on, was so important to me. And Linda, you're absolutely right. She is 100% integral to that book. And she's a fantastic character. So I'm really glad you picked her. She's great.
And then my number one, you kind of led me there with the notes when you said that, for example, Starman and all of his legacies, Will Payton's sister Jane, or Janie as Will refers to her more than once. Later on, I don't know why James Robinson changed her name to Sadie. I know it's in the story, but I don't think it was necessary in the James Robinson written Starman series. But Jane was such a great character in that 1980s Starman series starring Will Payton. She is the whole reason Will Payton became a hero.
So behind the scenes, Doug and I share a Google Doc is how we keep all this straight. And let me tell you, there was a lot of swearing on my end when I read Doug's list and he had Janie on there. Because literally, when we came up with this idea for the segment, the very first person I thought of, even before I thought of Lois Lane, was Janie from Will Payton's Starman. And I thought, no one's going to pick her. I've got that one in the bag. And then you went and picked it. And when I think of Janie, I don't even think of, I mean, obviously I know she was in the James Robinson series. I read it, all that. I was excited when she showed up. But for me, she's Will Payton's cool sister. Exactly. Yes. Like you mentioned. I mean, I loved Janie. In fact, this is so off the reservation. I don't care. I wrote a letter to the James Robinson Starman comic when it was being published about Janie saying, like I was complaining, basically saying, you know, you guys have all these great supporting characters, and there's a bunch of great supporting characters in the last Starman series too. Don't you want your supporting characters to be remembered years from now by other writers? Maybe you should do something with Janie and da-da-da-da. And my letter never got printed. And then, I don't know, 6 months, a year later, I figured out why.
So, but you gave him the idea.
I don't want to take credit for that, but great pick by you. She's a great one. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Well, you mentioned Will Payton's cool sister, and I'm going to add, you know, just given where that series was in the equivalency of our growing up, she was that cool sister that you kind of thought, yeah, I could maybe get a date with her if she were real.
I don't think I went there. I think I related. No.
So I'm the irredeemable one now.
Well, let me finish. It's because I related Janie to my sister, because I have a really cool big sister who's very cool lady. And I think I related Janie to her. So I didn't go down that path. Now, I mean, I am irredeemable. You know how I normally roll. So, and I got a few on my list that rolls that way too. So don't worry.
And so basically, listeners, I've just admitted to wanting to date Shag's high school version of his sister.
Oh my gosh. It's just going to some weird places. All right.
It's going really weird, man. Let's bring it back. It's all up to you, Shag.
So I'm going to give you a few that I considered that ultimately I didn't pick. Okay. Just because I got to mention them. They're great. You know, first off is Joan Williams or Joan Garrick, right? The girlfriend and later wife of J. Garrick, the Flash. She is an awesome character. I absolutely adore her. And especially in their, and I've talked about this a lot on the podcast. I adore in their senior years, how Jay and Joan are, quite frankly, very frisky, and they don't mind the readers knowing that. I love that. As an old person myself, I appreciate that. Yeah. Another one I considered picking was Inza Kramer or Inza Nelson, girlfriend and later wife of Kent Nelson, Dr. Fate. You know, eventually she goes on to be Dr. Fate herself for a while. But yeah. In the 1970s, they really developed her with this very forceful personality. I mean, she's pretty unpleasant sometimes, but she would chew Kent's butt out, like when he just wasn't, you know, paying enough attention to her or doing something stupid. And they gave her a great personality. I thought she was a fascinating character to read about. So always liked her.
Absolutely. Inza was a great character in that immortal Dr. Fate, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Then Dobie Dickles. I didn't end up picking him. And conceptually, I do love him, but I've never really read many stories that made me fall in love with him. I've read the occasional, you know, like maybe in something in an anthology or whatever, where she's got a couple of cute panels or whatever. But I know he's beloved. I just haven't got there myself. But I did strongly consider him because, you know, he's, when you think of non-power JSA assistants, he's kind of pretty big in the pantheon of that, I think.
Yeah. And I hadn't thought about Doiby until reading these notes, and now as you're saying it, Shag, I'm thinking about I'm gonna get just lambasted for this one. Plastic Man's buddy.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, not Bad Luck Hula, that's from the cartoon.
Yeah, no, it's Woozy Winks.
Yes, there you go. There you go.
Doiby Dickles and Woozy Winks, the team up in Brave and the Bold that we never got.
Right.
Someone out there, start drawing this.
That would be in a hoot. Oh my gosh. Okay. one more I considered. And I feel like I couldn't pick him because he did have a superpowered alter ego, but I wanted to pick Pat Duggan specifically as the stepfather to Stargirl. But since he operates as Stripe, I didn't feel like I could pick him. But like, I just think of him as her stepdad. Like Luke Wilson, you know, in the live action series, he's a great stepdad. And that's who I think it's a great character. I'm a stepdad myself, so it's meaningful to me.
Absolutely. Great choice.
All right. But none of those are my choices. Here we go. Here's my top five. Get ready, folks. In the number one, I guess there are no real order, but in the number one slot here, at least, is the O'Dare family. We've been talking a little bit about Starman. Well, Jack Knight supporting cast. You know, it's this multi-generational, according to Wikipedia, a multi-generational Irish-American law enforcement dynasty, which is pretty accurate, actually. So if you've never read Starman, it's a family of, they're all cops and they're all fantastic. They all have unique personalities, and James Robinson made them into real characters that you cared about. So the O'Dare family is fantastic.
That is a series or a movie or a series of movies waiting to happen with this new DCU entertainment. I mean, think about it. You could have the O'Dare family, and each movie or season could be a different member in a different generation with ancillary appearances, but it would have people tuning in because who knows who you're going to see? Oh, I saw Starman. Oh no, they're fighting Solomon Grundy. I mean, come on, make it happen.
It's an HBO Max series that writes itself. So.
Yes, it does.
All right, my next one is Ma Hunkel. Now, to be exact, I'm not talking about her in the 1940s as Red Tornado. I'm specifically talking about Ma Hunkel and her role in the 2000s as the JSA museum curator.
Good choice.
She's great. She's not only the museum curator, she's like everyone's favorite aunt. She takes care of everyone. She's got cookies and tea for everyone whenever they need it. She's an ear to listen when you're having a hard day. She's fantastic. This next one's a little bit of a stretch, but Dale Gunn, ally to the young Justice League of America member Steel. He was also an ally to Commander Steel, who was an ally of the JSA. So, I mean, that's kind of where I'm, you know, that's the All-Star Squadron, right? I mean, it's all connected.
Absolutely it is.
He's also quite the ladies' man. So I always liked Dale Gunn, and I wish he was still around and doing more stuff. I think he's great. Then this next one is Radu. Radu Stan, I think is a Stanku? I think, I'm probably saying that wrong. He is a Romanian immigrant and a proprietor of Radu's coffee shop in Greenwich Village. And he just so happens to be the landlord of Kyle Rayner, a legacy of Green Lantern, obviously. Radu was a great character. Like, he was, I don't know if you read the Kyle Rayner series, but he was just so fun. He'd always give Kyle advice or friend. And I can't remember whether he always knew Kyle was Green Lantern or just we kind of figured he probably knew, but he was just a great, great guy.
I remember wanting a Radu's coffee shop shirt, but I hadn't even thought about Radu for, geez, probably as long as the Hawkman companion's been out.
I reread a bunch of Kyle Rayner's comics not too long ago, and Radu is just so awesome in those.
That's a great choice.
And then my last one is Diane, or Dion, however you say it, Belmont, the lifelong partner, in every sense, quite frankly, to Wesley Dodds, the Sandman. She's the real deal. I mean, she's practically a superhero all by herself. Yes. Diane is amazing in Sandman Mystery Theater. In fact, the guys are covering, you know, the Sandman Slept Here, right here on the JSA Presents feed. And you can hear them quarterly talking about how great of a character she is. So
tune in for that.
Oh, it's great. It's a great show. You can just listen to those and skip JSA in the 90s. You'll be happier. but so those are my non-powered ally friends of the JSA. And folks, we want to hear yours at home. We just touched on a few, right? I mean, there's so many more. And every time you hear one more, you go, oh yeah, of course. Right.
Right.
So leave it in the comments section, share your allies, non-powered allies of JSA members. And you know what? Hey, if you want to step outside of the JSA, go ahead. You know, I think you had one that you were thinking about. You said you put in the comments that's not JSA related. So share your favorite allies to heroes. Those are great characters.
Awesome.
All right. Well, let's get into this, folks. So you can see some images from this issue, which is Justice Society of America number 5, cover dated August 1991. We're going to have some of those images on our website. You can check out the image gallery there. This issue was on the shelves June 18th, 1991. Cover price is $1 for shiny quarters. And the cover, once again, is drawn by Tom Lyle. You want to describe it for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a busy cover. It's got a lot of trade dress and blurbs. And this is when we were starting, I think, maybe starting to get credits on the cover regularly. So, of course, those have to be huge. And DC was tinkering with the corner box on this one, too, a little bit. But on the cover itself, Tom Lyle does that George Perez thing of filling the cover with rubble to add detail to the setting without distraction. Hawkman's muscular, but mortal because he's got his shoulder all wrapped up with an apparent wound. But he's able to keep up with Jay Garrick, who clearly is dialing back his speed to make Carter feel better and looks pretty pissed off about it. Lyle does a good job with this cover. And it's 1990s cover artwork. It's non-holographic, I would say best, but I think you've got some thoughts on it too, probably, Shad.
I do have some thoughts on this. Like, first off, I'll get some of the negatives out of the way because I do like this cover. But like you mentioned it, there's a lot of words on this cover. And if you think about this thing on a spinner rack, as it would be in 1991, where you can only see like the top third of the comic, right? If you look at the top third of the comic, there's almost no artwork. It's all words. It's, you know, DC, part 5 of 8, Justice Society of America, featuring Flash and Hawkman, issue 5. And the only art you get is that the corner box you mentioned, which I wonder if it's there on purpose because DC was not doing corner boxes at this time. They will play around with corner boxes on a regular basis in a year or two, but at this time they weren't doing it. So I wonder if that's why they added it here, simply because they wanted to show, first of all, more people than just the one hero, but also like we got to have some kind of art at the top. And I do love that corner box. I mean, it's come on. I mean, the little heads of Flash, Green Lantern, Starman, Hawkman, and Black Canary look so stinking good.
Yeah. And I wonder if it's what you were alluding to in our pre-chat chat about what was coming up. And maybe they were tinkering here, playing out with some ideas and seeing how things look and or sold on the cover, you know, as they tried it out to set up for that next big launch.
Yeah. Yep. Could be. Could very well be. I do like seeing that we've got two heroes on the cover because up to this point, every issue has been a solo hero. I mean, that's the way the series was designed specifically. The first 4 issues each have one hero. The 5 and 6 have 2 heroes each. 7 and 8 is the whole team together. So I love we're here. Finally, we've got 2 heroes together. They look fantastic. They do have very, very determined expressions, right? And they're running presumably towards danger, right? Not exactly right of the camera, but just a little bit of the skew of the camera. The only thing it's worth mentioning probably in this is like maybe there needed to be a faux or maybe a clear explanation of the danger, because otherwise it's just kind of an action pinup and you're not clear on what the threat is. Now, if you're reading the comic, you know, but if you don't, if you haven't been reading it, it's kind of like, what are they so angry about? But it looks great. I did think about your theory on how Flash is letting Hawkman beat him. Yeah. It could be that, you know, they decided to go. They said, all right, on three, go. And Flash actually ran all the way back to Keystone, you know, spent a little quality time with Joan, came right back. And so he's catching up. That could be what it is.
That's fair. That's fair. As for the cover itself, I mean, Tom Lyle's never been the hottest pick, but his art was never the sexiest either. But he was a good storyteller. And to your point, this cover needs a little something more happening. Either have them coming right at the reader viewer, because right now they're kind of into that middle distance, right? They're heading off over the maybe over your right shoulder somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fun. It gives you the showcase of the characters. Doesn't really spill too much on the content itself in the story. But I do have two hot takes on this cover. The first being, I hate that failure of a luchador mask that Carter's wearing. Talk it out, man. Talk it out, brah. Just wear that screaming hawk mask, because that's you. Own it. And then the other one.
Well, hold on. Before we leave that question, as the Hawkman companion guy, I mean, the mask is legitimate for the time period. Is that fair to say in 1950?
It absolutely is. Doesn't mean I have to like it.
Right. And why did they go to this mask? I've never understood that. Why in the 1940s were they just tired of drawing the beak or something?
That's got to be it. And honestly, it's been so long since writing the companion, I don't know that I got that answer in the conversations I had with Shelley Moldoff and George Kubert and, you know, whoever else. I hate to do it, but I might have to go back and read my own book to find out. But I honestly don't think I got into that at all.
Well, I'll come to defense of the luchador mask for a second in that.
Well,
because it was in Crisis. He was wearing that in Crisis as well, if I remember correctly. And that was the first one I came across. And it helped you distinguish immediately between Hawkman of Earth 1 and Hawkman of Earth 2. Because if you put the Screaming Hawk mask on him, it gets pretty hard to figure it out. I mean, they look pretty darn similar with both wearing hawk heads. So I think as much as the luchador mask means nothing, it means completely meaningless in regard to Hawkman, at least distinguishes between the two.
And to your point with the hawk girl, hawk woman mask situation, theirs were distinctly different.
Yes.
So that didn't need to happen. You didn't need to give Shara a luchador mask in any way, shape, or form. But I don't think we were at risk of the two Hawk ladies getting together as much as we were the Hawk men.
Right. Yeah, absolutely fair. All right, we ready to move inside?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. Writer is Len Strazewski. Penciler is Mike Parabek. There's our star team together again, Strazewski and Parabek, just like that 10-issue series we all love. Inker, Rick Burchett. Letterer, Janice Chiang. Colorist, Tom Zucchio. Editors are Brian Augustine and Mike Gold. The story is called Vengeance from the Stars, Part 5, Double Star Rising. You want to start us off?
Double Star Rising. Yeah, sure. So the story opens with Jay Garrick pondering something and doing a little high-speed science to make it happen before he zips out of the barracks to check on his ally Hawkman. Hawkman is being bandaged from his previous predicaments as the two heroes decide to rush headlong into New Mexico to Ted Knight's observatory. The cut to within said observatory sets up a solid piece of monologuing from our dreaded JSA foe, Vandal Savage. With Ted Knight literally broken and serving Savage from a wheelchair under duress of further torture, Vandal Savage fears nothing. And as Vandal Savage does, he begins patting himself on the back. Over the course of three pages of great Mike Parabek art, Savage rants about how things were better when he ruled Egypt. And he all but wrings his hands gleefully as his trap appears to be springing on Hawkman and Flash as they approach. Hawkman's weariness shows through in an uncharacteristically rough landing, and the comic book trope of those bursting bubbles indicative of a headache or a concussion, that is flashing around Hawkman visually. Mike Parabek's adding that in. So with the heroes in place, it's time to hatch their plan. With Will Wild Eagle joining them and following them on foot, the pair of JSAers leap into battle. They're leaping into battle against that celestial terror using the old high and low. Hawkman obviously going high while Jay Garrick attacks low. At less than 100%, Hawkman, through the thought bubbles, vows not to let his teammates down. And we get a bunch of inner monologuing where that helps actually set the parameters of where Carter is before the fight and before another Star Warrior joins the fray in the form of a dog.
So I'll take it from here. So Hawkman and Flash throw everything they've got at the star monsters. But these things are powerhouses, changing shape and even growing stronger whenever the heroes try to ground their enemy. One hero couldn't stop one of them, so two heroes aren't having any better luck against two. The JSA is getting battered until Flash and Hawkman finally stumble onto a weakness. If the living constellations touch each other, they short-circuit their own powers. So our heroes develop a strategy and just have to survive long enough to pull it off. So with Flash and Hawkman successfully short-circuiting both energy beasts, Vandal Savage is absolutely livid. He is done sitting on the sidelines. He grabs Starman's gravity rod and charges into the fight himself. And he makes it look easy. He drops his former adversaries with just a couple of blows. And it looks like Savage has won the battle. Until Hawkman's friend, Will Wild Eagle, lands a rifle shot that damages the gravity rod. Wild Eagle thinks he's turned the tide, but he has no idea that Solomon Grundy has finally arrived and is standing right behind him. Next month, part 6 with Green Lantern and Black Canary. All right. So what'd you think of the issue, buddy?
Loved it. So like you said, when I got wind that you were starting this JSA podcast, I immediately reached out and said, I need to be part of the Mike Parabek Love Fest and to get this comic and open it up to page 1 after the Tom Lyle cover, the serviceable, fine Tom Lyle cover. And I tried to use the Rob Kelly version of fine in that sentence. I mean, right away, Mike Parabek's just showcasing how talented and underrated he is. From page 1, panel 1. He's drawing the believable barracks setup, and, you know, there's science stuff all around, and there's enough busy detail to keep it all going on, but there's 18 Jay Garricks on this page.
In 5 panels, no less.
Right? And so the splash page gives him a little breather, but, you know, we get that big, huge zoom in on Hawkman, which is great, and it gives that very much pre-Savage Hawkman, where he's an ornery cuss, right? And that's established right here, right now. Let's move it forward for sure.
I love that. I mean, he's such a terrible patient, right? Like he's, and so is this where it starts? Or because like, did they ever establish, like, I don't know, whether in the Golden Age or maybe in Infinity Inc. or something, is the Golden Age Hawkman always been a bit of a jerk?
Oh, I'm sure he has, but I don't know that I ever really said, okay, it starts here, or that okay. Anyone has ever really noted it specifically. He's just had kind of a brashness or a hot-headedness that came across more as shorthand for being a jerk than anything else, I think.
Gotcha. All right. Well, I do also, along the same lines, I like that he's got the wound, they're bandaging it. It shows you there's consequences of the actions of the last issue, which will continue throughout this issue with Hawkman's concussion and all that. And I love Flash's, and here on this page and the next page, I love Flash's grin. He's got this giant, you know, crap-eating grin, and as Hawkman is just being more and more argumentative, Flash is clearly just eating this up. He is loving giving his friend a hard time and watching his friend struggle in just a funny way, and I love it.
Yeah, Jay Garrick's just a good-natured guy, isn't he?
Yes, he is, very much. In that last panel on page 3, where Hawkman tells the little soldier to carry his wings, if you look, and I read this in panel by panel mode, so that's why this panel really stood out to me. It's a like, you know, probably a private or something. He's a little short guy. His uniform's too big for him. The helmet, you know, hangs too low in his head. He's full of freckles and all that. And he picks up Hawkman's wings, and they're huge. They're massive to him. And he tries to walk through the door sideways, and he can't. And they like slam into the door frame. But you see his big googly eyes. You see the doctor in the back with his pipe laughing. I mean, to me, this kind of feels like a Norman Rockwell piece. I mean, I'm not saying this art's on par with Norman Rockwell, but the subject matter, the layout that he would tackle, that's kind of, it feels like a slice of Americana.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that was something that Parabek just excelled at. Just having that right camera angle that never really felt over the top, but gave you so much more of a story than just straight on.
Yeah.
He did it right. And he used the Alex Toth. Sorry, my stepdad's last name is Toth.
I've always said Toth. Is it supposed to be Toth?
I think it's Toth, but we can debate that or set it off on fire in the chat, or maybe that's a whole nother podcast. But regardless, Parabek uses the, I'm going to say, Alex Toth approach of fewer lines, the better.
Right? Yeah, agreed.
And while I'm, to use Rob Kelly's phrase again, while I'm waxing Mike Parabek's car, I haven't listened to all the podcasts, so I'm not sure where y'all are at. I know Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, has that honorific. So I'm not sure if there's an honorific of Mike Parabek, but maybe he's the incomparable Parabek or Parabek. Yeah, I don't know. But y'all need to get hopping because he certainly deserves something, I think.
You know, I wish we'd thought of that. Yeah, we never really picked an honorific. And we're kind of winding down on our Parabek coverage, actually, because we've already done the 1992 series. But it is fair to say all of our listeners, they absolutely love Mike Parabek's work. And he's very celebrated around here. So if anyone has any honorific suggestions, put those in the chat line in the comments, and they better be funny because it's got to be clever. It's got to be some good wordplay. Like, what did you say? Para-heck, yeah.
Para-heck, yeah.
It is such a dad joke. Oh my gosh.
Isn't it? Yeah, and we'd already talked about Will Wild Eagle. So, I mean, just continuing my thoughts here since I'm downloading at this point. But we talked about Will Wild Eagle and how he seems like he had potential to be so much more. And I'll be honest with you, I haven't read past this issue yet this time. I know I've read it in the past.
Yep.
So I don't know if Will has the potential to continue or if that Solomon Grundy in the background is just going to be bad news for Will in general. But Will's got potential. Let's see it, right?
He might take his pants. I mean, Solomon Grundy's got a thing for pants. I was also thrilled to see Will Wild Eagle as well, because last issue, I'm also not reading ahead. I mean, I've read him before, but I'm not reading ahead again. And I was lamenting last episode, you guys may remember, is that Will is in the first half of the issue and he's great. And then he just disappears. And I was like, what was the point of introducing this great character if you're not going to bring him back? And now he's here again, like, oh, okay. So that was Straczynski's plan, was to bring him in this issue, which is great. So I'm very happy to see that the character development wasn't wasted. And he's just a cool guy. I mean, I love that they're sitting talking, you know, because he's Native American. And they're talking about the Native American weapons, like his grandfather's spear and his grandfather's tomahawk. He's not interested in that. He's got a rifle that he used to fight in Iwo Jima. And that's what he wants. And I think that's fantastic. I love this character. And he calls Carter on his crap. Like, Carter comes out. You know, he comes out. Wild Eagle's like, hey, you ready to go? And Carter's like, excuse me, sir. I don't know you. It's like, oh, cut the crap, Carter. I love that.
All the more reason that there's potential there. Let's start that Bring Back Will Wild Eagle campaign. Let's get it going.
Let's do it. Do it.
Will Wild Eagle for president.
According to DC, it all matters now, right? So, I mean, there's no reason he couldn't be around.
Yep. Or absolute Will Wild Eagle. How about that?
Oh, my gosh.
All right, getting back to it, the limitations. So Carter Hall's, Hawkman's limitations are spelled out very quickly in thought bubbles for us on page 11, which is something that comics just don't do anymore. They'd maybe stack some caption boxes over into the corner for us, but here you're actually seeing the grimace on Hawkman's face as he's thinking, you know what, I can't let these folks down even though I'm hurting, but boy, am I hurting.
Yeah.
And that's something that just feels like it is of the time.
The loss of thought balloons kills me because they were great for conveying information. Again, yeah, the as you said, the caption box sort of serves that function for the most part, but you lose something. You do lose something. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then continuing on through the story, so we get to these celestial beings, and there's one, and that's fine. So 90s coloring had limitations for sure, and Parabek and Burchett were really pouring their work into this, which is great, but the celestial beings are just so visually busy. And I'm not saying I don't appreciate what's there. There's just so much going on. Not only do you have their physical acting and taking up of the space, but you've got the exhibition of the powers. You've got the stars within their negative energy appearance. And what would be a highlight is now a shadow. And what would be a shadow is now a highlight. And then on top of that, you've got the electrostatic glow around them. And it's just a lot to pack into a panel and still try and get the storytelling going. And Parabek, don't get me wrong, he does a great job of balancing that storytelling with the bizarre, the shock and the awe of what these things must look like, but it's still just it's a lot. And it doesn't feel muddy, but it doesn't feel clean.
And I will agree with you. Like in the previous issues, when there was just one celestial being, it worked. Okay. You were able to tell what was going on. When there's two and he's throwing 5, 6, 7 panels on a page, it does get more difficult. And I'm reading both the digital copy and the physical one. The digital is actually clearer. The physical one's even harder, you know, because it's, you know, 30 years of the ink being absorbed by the paper too. It is harder to see some of the detail. It's not impossible. It's not like it's completely impossible, but it is, you're right. It is a little busier than I didn't even think about it until you mentioned it. So it is a bit of a struggle there. But one of the things I do like as you get into the fight though, compliment to Parabek, is he ramps up the energy and the pace. Like before the fight starts really on page 12, most of the pages are like 3 panels, you know, a splash page, maybe 5 panels, whatever. This page on page 12 where the fight starts, he ramps it up to 9 panels, which really gives you a sense of action. It gives you sort of a sense of frenetic pace. And so the panel design itself is giving more energy to the fight than a static image normally would do. So from a storytelling perspective, that's really clever. I really like that.
Yeah. And he keeps all his work paneled. It's all within gutters. It's all classic comic appearance as befits Golden Age heroes, right? It's not huge splash pages with full bleeds. It's literally a Golden Age story told in a Golden Age style.
And it looks great. Can't say enough good things about this artwork. And clearly this is, you know, a big reason why he was given the green light for the next JSA series is how much they love his work on this.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I really love that he does is he gives us the indication, the wink and the nod as artists to readers that, you know what, you can't contain the Flash within a panel. And there's more than one panel, but especially down at the bottom of 14, as Flash, Jay Garrick is running away and he is literally running out of the panel.
Oh, yeah.
That's just such a little brilliant showcase of power. And it's just so fun.
Yeah. Since we're talking about Jay, I got to mention, from the story perspective, like Jay Garrick, the Flash, he sucks as a teammate, because in this issue, as you read it, there's a plot point where he didn't bother to tell Hawkman about the second constellation being, didn't bother to mention, oh, by the way, it's like a constellation dog that he fought in issue one. Oh, and by the way, it also can transform into a human, a humanoid type shape. Forgot to mention that as well. What a pal, Jay, you know, really share some information. Why don't you? I mean, Hawkman calls him out on it. He's like, were you planning to tell me about this? It's waiting for the right time, apparently.
Jay. Yeah. And the last page with Solomon Grundy just kind of appeared behind a rock. Where does Solomon Grundy hide? I don't care that you're in a desert. Where are you hiding, this big dude?
I mean, that makes a good point. He's coming all the way from, I think it's Gotham City, where he just fought Alan Scott and I don't know. I don't know how he gets to New Mexico at this point. I would assume to get to the observatory, he had to come either by car or helicopter. So I don't think he walked. So, I didn't think about how he got there. I actually thought it was a pretty cool dramatic moment where, you know, Wild Eagle's like, you know, now it's just you and me. And, and Vandal's like, really? I mean, it's a great image, but now you've ruined it with logic. So thank you so much for that.
Well, I'll throw on a little bit more logic. He's got a smell.
Oh, you leave that swamp zombie alone.
I mean, exactly. He's a swamp zombie. I mean, yeah.
Don't be shaming swamp zombies. That's not nice. Don't scent shaming swamp zombies.
Y'all living in Florida in late summer probably have that smell right outside your door somewhere.
Or on our own bodies after being outside in the humidity for 30 seconds.
Fair enough.
Well, I want to go back and talk about Vandal Savage, because this is actually an important moment here. We have been covering this series now for a long time, and the thing that we have noticed through all of these issues is they've never actually revealed Vandal Savage's identity. They've always either showed him in shadows. Issue 3, they actually showed him, but never said who he was. He did talk about how he fought with the Nazis and things like that, but they still didn't say his name. So some reader who may not be very familiar with Vandal Savage, because, you know, he hadn't really done around much since the 70s, really. I may not even have any clue who this guy was. So here in this issue, on page 7, he refers to the Palace of Savage, who the Egyptians called Cheops. So nearly there. Ted Knight calls him Savage on page 8, almost. But finally on page 20, the heroes, either Green Lantern or Flash, I don't remember, I'm sorry, Hawkman or Flash says, you know, he finally calls him Vandal Savage. So after 5 issues, more than halfway through the miniseries. But they don't even make it a big reveal. It's not even like giant letters, you know, like a font, Vandal Savage. I think part of what it is, and we've talked about this in previous episodes, is all the promotional material for this series, but prior to issue number 1, said the villain was Vandal Savage. Like literally, Vandal Savage fights the JSA, blah, 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 blah. And so it was out there. And then they spent 4 issues trying to keep it a secret in the physical comic itself. So it could have been by this point, they're like, look, everyone knows, you know, everyone knows it's Vandal Savage. Who cares? Just say his name. So I don't know. Again, I don't know how that came about one way or another, but either way, it's finally there. It's finally out there. We can all agree it's Vandal Savage. The surprise, the quote unquote surprise, is finally over.
Well, and Vandal Savage for newer readers. So I'm considering myself a newer reader to the JSA experience at this point when this came out in 1991.
Yep.
Vandal Savage was the first villain to appear in Wally West's Flash comic. At that point, where had he been before that? And so for me, starting with a Flash number 1, meeting Vandal Savage, I had no idea he had this type of history or that, you know, he stretched all the way back to Egypt. I just learned what I learned as I was meeting this guy in whatever that was, 1985.
87. I had forgotten that Vandal Savage, and I still don't remember, I'm trusting you, that Vandal Savage was the villain in those early I remember him around issue 50 or something like that. But I had forgotten that he was in those early issues with Wally. So that's interesting. Yeah. So I guess when I said no one had seen Vandal Savage since the 70s, I'm incorrect. Because, you know, he was in the 40s, came back in the 70s. He had a little bit of roles with the JSA, had a little bit of roles in the Superman books, then went away again. And maybe the Flash is what brought him back then. And then they get him here. So he didn't have a robust catalog of appearances that people might know him from. And I got to say, I love the way Parabek draws him. Like the body language.
Oh, yeah.
As like reclining in the chair, standing triumphant, holding the gravity rod up, you know, sort of screaming in Ted Knight's face. I mean, it's just excellent work on Vandal Savage all the way around, showing him, you know, relaxed, arrogant, angry, the whole range of emotions. It's really, really well done.
Yeah, and from all different angles too. Like Parabek is just, he is so masterful and so underrated.
And you talked about in your recap on how he's bragging about how 2,000 years ago, how he ran the world better. And he really demonstrates what a horrible person here is. He is. He goes, you know, when I ruled Egypt, we built to last. The Sphinx still standed undaunted by the ages. And we knew how to use people. We never had any labor troubles, except for that brief Moses situation. Like, whoa!
And he said it with a little sneer, too. That Moses situation.
Right. Apparently he's held a grudge for 2,000 years. So, wow. Well, it's also worth mentioning. So, since issue 1, Ted Knight has been in a wheelchair, injured by Vandal Savage. And here, once Vandal Savage leaves the room in page 19, Ted suddenly seems to like get a second wind, or he snaps out of it, whatever, and he's hatching a plan. So, it's kind of exciting. It's the first time we've seen him really do anything of value since issue 1. And maybe it's hinting that he's just stalling for time, and maybe he's not as injured as we think.
Nice.
Yep.
That tricky Ted Knight.
And then I just comment on Wild. I keep calling him Wild Eagle. Will Wild Eagle. He did more damage to Vandal Savage in that one shot in one panel than anyone has done in all 5 issues of this miniseries so far. So really, Will Wild Eagle's currently the leader in the battles right now. So good for him.
Again, Will Wild Eagle for president. Let's go.
So, all right, now, this is some internet research. This is not my own information, but in here, Vandal Savage is watching some television and some old 1950 TV show. I was not familiar with any of what was happening on the screen. Did you recognize what they were trying to represent here?
No.
Okay.
No all idea. Right.
Well, a couple
maybe Abbott is still on the first one.
Right. I thought maybe the Honeymooners, you know, whatever. I don't know. But according to the wisdom of the internets, it says that these are scenes from the Danny Thomas show. However, The Danny Thomas Show began airing in 1950. So this would be really the first historical mistake they've made, because they've thrown a lot of historical references in this series. But they've all been accurate. You know, Edward R. Murrow, different things like that. But this would be the first one that, if that is right, if anyone else, you know, you can see some of these images, let us know if you think that is The Danny Thomas Show or you think it's something else. Well, we've mentioned it on previous episodes, but I just want to say it again. One of the things I love that I thought was very clever when they did this series is the five JSA members they picked. All of them had 1991 counterparts with their own books on the stand, right? We've got Jay Garrick Flash. Well, Wally West has his own book. We've got Alan Scott Green Lantern. Well, Hal Jordan's got his own book. We've got Carter Hall. Well, Katar Hall has Hawkworld on the stands. You know, we've got Ted Knight. Well, we've got Starman with Will Payton on the stands. And then we've got Dinah Lance. Well, Dinah Drake, Black Canary, is appearing in Green Arrow, and she's about to get her own miniseries. So I just thought that was very clever for them to pick characters that have modern day counterparts, because they thought that might help the series sell better.
Absolutely. That's cool. I hadn't mathed that out before, and I think I was getting all of those.
I didn't put it together either. I had to get it out of the letters column. So that's where I got it from. So two more ads. I just want to talk about some ads. One is, you know, in issue one, in the letters page, you know, they were dancing around this secret project they couldn't announce that these artists were going to be working on. We all know, you know, with hindsight, it's Impact Comics. But at the time with issue one, they couldn't tell us that's what they were working on. And, you know, this series was designed to keep all the creative talent, or most of the creative talent, for Impact. Give them a job, give them something to do until they could ink this deal with Archie or Red Circle or whoever it was to get the Impact Comics up and running. Well, here we are with issue five, and finally there is a full page ad for Impact Comics, you know, featuring the Web, Legend of the Shield, Jaguar, Comet, and Fly. So thankfully they have all that worked out finally, and they're going to begin to publish the Impact Comics, which is great.
Were you a big Impact reader?
I bought Jaguar is the one I stuck with the longest, as I recall, as well as the Comet. Those were the two that were like my jam. I think I read the number ones of all of them. I bought the Fly for a while, and Legend of Shield for a while, and maybe Black Hood and stuff like that. But ultimately, Jaguar and Comet were kind of my jam. What about you?
Didn't really make it past number one on any of them.
Really? Okay.
I tried recently to try and get back into the Fly with the, you know, those are glorious dollar bin dive comics, but just gave up on trying to pull that one together.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, some of our listeners are big fans of Comet and say that that series is really interesting and goes in some very surprising directions. So I'm looking forward to diving back in and rereading them someday. So it's supposed to be good stuff.
Are they on the DC app?
Unfortunately not. They're all tied up in rights issues, you know?
All right.
So, but like you said, they're in, you know, quarter bins, 50 cent bins, dollar bins. They're easy fodder. So one last ad I got to mention, and this is for purely selfish, nerdy reasons. There is an ad for the Science Fiction Book Club, and it's one of these where it's like a bunch of books, and it says you can choose any five for $1 with membership. So the deal is you would pay $1, you get five books, and then you got to buy, like, I don't know, five more within a year. And the prices were slightly inflated on the ones you had to buy later, but man, oh my goodness, the number of times I joined the Science Fiction Book Club to get those sweet, sweet five books for $1. And then I'd fulfill my membership obligation. I played by the rules. I'd fulfill it. I'd cancel my membership. And I immediately rejoined for those sweet, sweet five books for $1. And let me tell you, I did this several times across the 1990s and 2000s. And a lot of people thought it was a scam because the books were a little more expensive. But if you knew how to work the system, for those five free books, you know, you get like a, towards the end, I was getting like giant, you know, Marvel encyclopedias that were like $40. You know, if you know which ones to buy, the more expensive books for the $5, you come out ahead. I was a huge fan of the Science Fiction Book Club, and still it holds a very special place in my heart.
Was it like the CD ones at all, where if you referred a friend, you got like five free or something too?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't have any friends. I was a nerd. What are you talking about?
Yeah, right. Sorry. This is the Science Fiction Book Club we're talking about.
Exactly. I don't know about that. I don't know. But I loved that club. And they'd have a newsletter they would send out. I would read every word in it. I actually found one of my favorite authors, Jack McDevitt, came out of a Science Fiction Book Club recommendation. So anyway. Anyway, wow. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about, other than it brings me joy. So, then the letters page. The only thing I want to mention there is a very long letter in here from Jerry Bales, who's known as the father of comic book fandom. So that's worth checking out. I mean, he's very complimentary of issue one and says a little bit about JSA history and things like that. So he was very pleased. That's pretty cool.
Nice.
All right, Doug. Well, it is time for the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it's a story beat, something in the art, maybe something that made us laugh, you know, whatever. Whatever we like, both myself and Doug will pick one moment and only one to spotlight, and each of those will earn an All-Star Award. Doug, you're the guest, so why don't you go first?
Page one. There's no thought. There's no... It's page one. I opened this cover and got that beautiful five-panel story of Jay Garrick and got the whole story in one page with, as I mentioned, 18 Jay Garrick zipping around the place. That's fantastic. If I could own that page, it would definitely be framed and on the wall. Without a doubt.
It's a great one. It's a really great page. No doubt about that.
How about you, Shag?
For me, I'm going to pick page four, which is where when Hawkman comes out and Will Wild Eagle's waiting for him. And Hawkman's like, he's calling them, sir. And excuse me, I don't know you. And Will just, cut it out, Carter. And, you know, and again, he's like, you know, forget the ancient weapons. Will's got a rifle and he's ready to go. And I love the banter, the friendship it's established really quickly and done really well. And I absolutely love that, those interactions. So that's my pick for the All-Star Award. And they're both fantastic moments and both well-deserving. So congratulations to Jay Garrick and to Will Wild Eagle on your All-Star Awards. Please wear them with pride, or please put it in a place of honor. You know, maybe, I don't know, above your mantle where you put all your, I don't know, Hawkman leather straps that go across your chest that are a little awkward at parties. But anyway, Doug, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit to ensure those living constellations don't come back? I'm just worried about a giant dog made of stars and a giant horse made of stars ruining this place.
Okay, Shag. I'll keep an eye out, but I am not on star dog or star horse duty, if you know what I mean.
Fair enough, sir. Fair enough. I totally understand. Now, don't worry, Doug. We will bring you back to the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages.
Do you worship at the Church of Zemed? Do you still think teenagers should look like they're in their mid-40s? If you gained magical powers, would you use them to sexually harass a woman? Well, if your answer is a resounding yes, do we have a podcast for you. Sleazebag Cinema with Andrew and Mike. We're doing a deep dive into questionable 80s flicks starring some of pop culture's most beloved icons. How in the hell did they avoid being canceled? Join Mike and Andrew for a peek through the peephole to find out. Sleazebag Cinema. Episode 1 coming soon to all respectable podcast platforms.
Xenozoic Xenophiles,
a fan podcast devoted to the comic series Xenozoic Tales.
It's a post-apocalyptic adventure series filled with Cadillacs and dinosaurs.
I'm Ruth.
And I'm Darren.
Please join us as we discuss the stories, characters, and art in this excellent comic series from writer and artist Mark Schultz.
Special episodes feature interviews with Mark Schultz himself discussing Xenozoic Tales and his other comics.
Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and YouTube.
Follow us at Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky, or visit XenozoicXenophiles.com.
We're RAD, R-A-D, which is short for Ruth and Darren.
And we're at RadAdventuresNetwork.com.
The Society Pages. The The Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. Now, in other podcast news, you might want to check out the Word Balloon podcast from May 4th, 2026. John Suntrist has a guest on there named Scott Larson, and they cover the career and life of Len Strzuski. Given how many Len Strzuski JSA comics we've been covering over the past year or two, might be worth checking out. Thanks to Dave Tomko for that heads up. Now, folks, as we get into your feedback, I want you to get out on the social media, find us as JSA Presents, because as I always say, it's about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. Now, I do have a favor to ask. If you don't mind, please consider going out to iTunes or Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. It really helps raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. And if you look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Justice Society Presents, just takes a second. It's absolutely free and it'll help us. And quite frankly, we haven't gotten many new reviews lately, and my ego demands it. So please, anyway, as a thank you, I will read your entire iTunes Apple Podcast review on the air. So look for Justice Society Presents. All right, now I went out to our website and I collected all of your comments from the last episode and the comments I could find on social media. I put it together in a Google document and it's pretty darn long, so I can't read every single word, but I'm going to acknowledge every single person that left a comment on our website and read a portion of their comments. Now, first up, I have an email, old business, from our coverage of JSA number 4, Billy D from the Magazines and Monsters podcast and A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, sent us a note. It says, another fun edition, and I'd love to hear J. David Weider alongside you for this one. The wealth of knowledge you guys have, along with the love of this title and team, really lifts my spirits today while listening in. Listening to great podcasts while I'm at work is a blessing, and you and Dave are definitely at the top of my list for podcasters that can convey your joy of these comics. Oh, well, thank you, Billy D. Appreciate that. Now, moving on to our comments from the previous Spotlight episode, where we discussed Greg Saunders, the Vigilante, with my guest Ranger Gord. First up, we've got Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princess and Other Stories. Rob says, wow, another DC from the 90s I had no idea about. Glad that we could point it out to you, Rob. Hope you checked it out. Then we heard from M.A. Salko from the Pod Opaque. He says, I didn't have hearing a Corb Lund song on a Shag podcast in my entire stack of bingo cards. Bravo, Ranger Gord. Yeah, I mean, Ranger Gord, I think, blew everyone away as a guest, especially when he sang that. So thank you, Salko. Then we're from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He says, he's the last singing cowboy singing songs of inspiration of joy. This was a great episode. I've had issue 3 of this series for a while, but after hearing this, I'm definitely going to have to track down the rest of the series so I can read it all the way through. I didn't realize Bugsy Siegel played such a big part in it. I'll have to check out the movie Bugsy. Well, I hope you like it, Bucky. Then we're from Brett Miller, who says, this is one of two podcasts that I pull out of order to listen to. Oh, wow, Brett. I'm flattered. Then he goes on to say, this and B-Squad Hot Rod, because that's one I sometimes guest host on. Then he says, I've now watched the Vigilante serial. Better than most because the cliffhanger endings aren't fudged like most, and Stuff has to be the worst sidekick name ever. Aw, Brett. I think Ranger Gore did a good job defending Stuff, at least as a character, if not his name, last episode. Then we heard from Comic Foil, who says, this episode was phenomenally entertaining and informative. Ranger Gord brought a 10-gallon hat full of knowledge to the show, and I was simply blown away by all the Las Vegas nuggets he was dropping completely off the cuff. I was only slightly considering looking for these comics before listening. Now I'm on the hunt. Tip of the hat to both Gord and Shag for this one. It was a real pleasure tuning in. Yeah, Gord was amazing on that episode, wasn't he? It was such a pleasure to have him on the show. Then we're from Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog, Comic Box Commentary, and the Legion of Super Bloggers. Dr. Ange says, great episode all around. First off, fascinating that there was so much true crime in this with Bugsy Siegel. And then it says, Chiarello was DC's art director for a long time. I liked his style on the covers, unique and almost old school movie poster style. He did interior art on the Batman Houdini Elseworlds if you want to see more. Dr. Ange, you just blew my mind, because that Batman Houdini Elseworlds was one of my favorites, because my dad, growing up, he was a professional magician. So not only did I buy myself a copy of the Batman Houdini Elseworlds, I also bought a copy for my dad, and it's on his shelf with his other, like, official Houdini books. So, anyway, just that makes me very happy to hear Dr. Ange. And he says, but I have to say, the internal art just didn't do it for me. For sure, there's a heavy Frank Miller feel to it, but just a feel, not the real thing. And I wonder if the color compounds the problem. I wonder if this would have worked better as a black and white. Anyways, great discussion around Vig. Then we're from John Stibe, who says, I listened to this episode this morning, and it was a hoot. It was fun to hear Ranger Gore just talk, but it was even more fun to hear him sing. It was a great show about a V-list character that I also really like. I mean, a cowboy on a motorcycle? What's not to love? But I was not a fan of this miniseries when I bought it and read it back in the day. I love James Robinson in the 90s, and I love the Golden Age characters, so I thought this was going to be amazing. However, like Dr. Ange above, the art of Tony Salmon's just did not work for me. It was hard for me to even couldn't figure out what was going on at times. I know art is subjective, so I also know this is somebody's all-time favorite miniseries, but not for me. Regardless of this, both Shag and Ranger Gordon made a joyful episode. Thanks for the fun, partners. Hey, you know, just a message to John and Dr. Ange, I totally get it, right? I mean, art is very subjective, and for me, I think I struggled the first time I read the series as well, but one of the things you do for a podcast is you read stuff, and you reread it, and then you reread it, and you reread it to get ready for the podcast, right? And when you're doing it, you really start noticing all these different details, so I think it warmed to me, and I feel like we were, you know, pretty honest about it going into it. I think we said on the podcast several times that the art took a lot getting used to and was not glamorous and things like that, and compare the style. So anyway, either way, your opinions are absolutely valid, and I totally get where you guys are coming from. So I appreciate you both listening, and I appreciate the honest feedback, and thanks for the kind words about the podcast itself. All right, up next was Super Captain. It says, I wasn't aware of the series, but now I want to check it out. James Robinson was hitting on all cylinders in this era, and I think I first encountered Vigilante during one of his appearances in one of the anthology books. The country singer's secret identity is one of the most interesting backgrounds of the Golden Age. Great job, Ranger Gord and Shag. Thanks, Super Captain. Then we're from Uncle Bruno from Uncle Bruno's Customs. He says, Ranger Gord, you've never seen a lever-action shotgun? I highly suggest you check out a small, independent film I saw in the early 1990s. The governor of California goes back in time to save a teenage white supremacist from Peacemaker's dad, who is not a white supremacist yet. At one point, he's shooting an 1887 lever-action shotgun while riding a motorcycle. The director went on to make a long, boring movie about a boat sinking. Years later. You may have seen that one. Oh my God, you're killing me. Then he says, but seriously, great job, guys. And thank you, Gord, for ensuring that Prairie Justice was said correctly throughout the episode. My introduction to Vigilante Stuff and the Dummy was in the World's Finest issue you mentioned. Maybe it's because I was watching reruns of The Lone Ranger Saturday mornings, or maybe it was the Chinatown noir look Gray Morrow gave the story, but I thought Vigilante was awesome. A couple years later, I picked up one of my first issues of Detective Comics, and his nephew, the Swashbuckler, appeared and talked about his Uncle Greg. I was like, I know that guy. I thought Swashbuckler was so cool that I'd pretend to be him. I was disappointed to find out later that he was not a big part of the DC universe, which is a massive understatement. Anyways, almost 50 years later, and the cover photo to my Facebook page has been the dummy running from Vig and the Seven Soldiers. I could go on waxing your iron steed some more, but instead I'll say, happy trails, partner. Well, thank you, Uncle Bruno. Then Hal follows it up and says, don't know if you're aware of Zoom and now Isamu Yukinori doing a fan-based version of Who's Who with characters that were left out of the original series. Issue 3 will have a profile on Swashbuckler. And Uncle Bruno followed up and says, I've got both issues and I can't wait for the third. Yeah, folks, I'm getting really excited about the third issue of Zoom's Who. In fact, my nephew, Isamu, recently gave me a heads up on one of the entries for that book. And I cannot wait to see issue 3. It's going to be amazing. All right, then we're from Jose Rivera, author of The Underground Adventures. He says, I got to admit, this is a blind spot for me, as this miniseries I don't see many people talking about. A Vigilante series written by James Robinson in the 90s? How did I miss this? That being said, I have to track down the single issues or the trade paperback for this one, as it sounded amazing. And while the story takes place in the 40s with gangsters in Las Vegas, I'm a sucker for a story with a gunslinger. There's something classic about a Western hero, no matter what era he's in. And kudos to Ranger Gord for the excellent usage of the word gunsel. Between this and the recent Dr. Midnight episode, I'm loving these spotlight episodes on miniseries that would otherwise been lost to time. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you, Jose. They were from Paul Keehan from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He has shows like the DC Special Cast and the Sandman Slept Here, right on the Justice Society Presents podcast feed. Paul says, great episode. Ranger Gord was a great guest. I remember liking this mini back in the day, but I agree with Ange that Chiarello did some great things as art director, bringing in talent, cover schemes, and more, but I didn't warm to his art either. All right. Well, thank you, Paul. Then we're from Jordan Jennings from Extremely Uncanny and the host of the podcast Neverending Battle. Jordan says, great episode as always. I didn't realize there was a Greg Saunders Vigilante miniseries in the 90s, but now I need to seek out a copy. This story sounds right up my alley, and it's neo-noir gangster trappings and themes about the hollow taste of revenge and obsession. I really loved hearing Ranger Gordon in this episode. He brought some meaningful insight to Greg Saunders that I was unaware of. This episode also made me want to check out the Bugsy movie that Ranger Gordon was talking about. A very reoccurring theme you're hearing, guys. It's like people was not aware of this miniseries, so I'm really glad that the Spotlight put a spotlight on the miniseries, and more people are going to check it out. Then we heard from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, cool podcast and awesome to hear about the Vigilante. He was cool on Justice League Unlimited and in the few comics I've read him in. Jeez, his partner's name was Stuff? I thought Wing was bad. Still, the comic is good, and I like how Vig was featured in it. James Robinson was the king of the 1990s comics. Not sure what happened. You know, Liz, there was definitely a rough period after James Robinson kind of left comics, but then he came back around, I don't know, off the top of my head, 2005, 2006, maybe. There was some rough stuff there, but he's been putting out a lot of great comics with smaller publishers recently that are definitely worth checking out. Then we heard from Dave Tomko from the new Earth 2 website. Dave says, great episode, guys. It was a ton of fun and very informative. The series had been on my want-to-get list ever since Starman was coming out, but I never managed to track it down. After listening to this episode, I finally sought it out and was excited to read it. Unfortunately, it didn't quite live up to the version I built up in my head, but that's probably on me. That said, I really enjoyed the story it told and the inclusion of the real-life gangster Bugsy Siegel. Weaving a historical figure into a superhero story reminded me a bit of how Oscar Wilde was incorporated into James Robinson's Starman alongside The Shade. As you both mentioned in the episode, though, this feels more like a Bugsy Siegel story than a vigilante one. Speaking of which, now I have to track down the movie Bugsy. Where the comic falls short a little for me is the artwork. I do enjoy Tony Salmon's style, and I see quite a few similarities to Tim Sale's work. Unlike Sale, though, I think Salmon struggles to make his characters visually distinct. The heavy use of shadows also made it difficult to tell characters apart, which made the book a tougher read than it needed to be. I turn the page, see a new scene, and find myself wondering whether I was looking at the same character or someone else. Sometimes it was the same character, and sometimes it wasn't. The frequent scene changes also could have benefited from more distinctive color palette to provide visual clues about shifts in location and time. Reading this book also reminded me of an interview with Jeff Johns in which he talked about rereading his scripts after receiving the finished artwork. He would tweak or cut dialogue that had become unnecessary because the art was already telling the story. I think this book could have benefited from a similar approach. Adding a few narration boxes to smooth the transitions between scenes and locations also would have helped. All that said, I enjoyed it enough to add the movie to my watch list, and if they ever did a follow-up comic, it'd be on my pull list. All right, well, thank you, Dave. And again, I appreciate the honest opinions about the book. Then Robert Junker says, excellent series. Can't wait to give it a listen on my drive home. I need to dig this one back out and give it a read. Billy Hines, comic enabler and victim, says, fans of the excellent Vigilante miniseries should also check out the excellent Legends of the Dark Knight, issue number 85, by Robinson and Salmons. A frenzied one-shot with Batman racing through death traps and a skyscraper to reach the top before the bad guy gets away in a helicopter like a 1980s beat-em-up. Wow, Billy, that's a deep cut. Thanks for letting us know. Yeah, the same creative team. That's interesting. Anthony P. says, Vigilante, City Lights, Prairie Justice is such an underrated miniseries. It's James Robinson going full James Ellroy. And we did receive lots of kind words. I just wanted to name check a few folks that posted just very brief comments. Andrew Redheaded Fanboy, Justin Steiner, and Dr. Pop Culture USA. Thank you so much, guys, for the shout out. Then also want to thank a couple of people who mentioned us on their websites. Dave Tomko over on the New Earth 2 website gave us a shout out for our recent episodes. Thank you. And Anthony Cardino also gave us a shout out on his blog. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate that. Now, this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared our show on their social media timeline. So we're talking about Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. It is a long list of names. However, these folks showed their support and promoted the show. So it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. And this time out, we've got over 75 people who helped promote the last episode of the show. Now, as I've been saying the last few months, there's actually probably more than that, because Facebook and Instagram are being a royal pain, and I still can't see who's resharing over there anymore. I have to collect that information from my notifications manually, and it's pretty hit or miss. I'm getting better at it at Facebook, but Instagram shares are still really challenging, so I did my best, folks. Now, you could be on this list next month. It's just as easy by sharing or retweeting or whatever it's called on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. Our thanks go out to Al the Comics Guy, Alan Boyce Jr., Andrew Redheaded Fanboy, Anthony Cardino, Anthony P., Barry Reese's Infinity Ink Tumblr, Benjamin Hall, Between the Pages Blog, Bill Beer, Bill DeSimone, Billy Hines, Black Vulcan 69, Brad Dade, Brett Young, Brian Schufo, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Clinton Robinson, Comic Foil, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Dan Dougherty, Dave Tomko in his DC New Earth 2 account, Dave's Comics Heroes Blog, David Ace Gutierrez, David Emery Bogas, David Gallagher, Derek Crabb, Diablo Frank, Dr. Pop Culture USA, The Earth 2 Podcast, Ed Moore and his Teal Productions account, Extremely Uncanny, Gentleman Joey, J. David Weeder, John Stibe, Joseph Dredd, J.P. Roca, Justin Steiner, Keen Comics, Kichi Baker, Lizanne Oswald, M.A. Salko, Magazines and Monsters, Mark at MDB 1958. Martin Gray, Michael Bradley, Mike Thomas, Nerdy Textile Artist, Nuno Duarte, Otaku Mike, Parker Oliveira 92, Paul Kean, Pop Culture Basement Podcast Network, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, Roger Preeb, Ryan Daly in his Batman Nightcast account, S. Matthew Stolte, Sam Lowe, Scott X, Sean Rouse in his Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast account, Steve Gibbons, Stream Boost 1, Super Blog Team Up Facebook Group, The Telltale Mind, Tim Price and his Outcasters Under Siege, an Avengers podcast account, Venkman, Watch This Space, and Zek Cap Boots. Whew. My thanks to all of you for your support of the JSA in the 90s podcast. Seriously, guys, your feedback is such a critical part of the show, and this community of JSA fans we're building together is the best. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It's probably the fault of Ranger Gort. I do my best to find all the social media comments, but as we've discussed, sometimes they do fall through my internet fingers. So please keep those cards and letters coming. Visit our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. Leave your comments on the show post there, and fellow JSA fans can share their thoughts, and we can communicate together. You can also find us on most social media platforms as JSA Presents, including Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter or X, and Threads, or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. My thanks again to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and we'll come back, we'll connect with this episode's guest, Doug Zavisha, and we'll see how he managed with the mess left behind by the Star Dog and Star Horse.
The most irregular Batman podcast returns. Bailey's Batman podcast is back with a new mandate and an actual honest-to-God release schedule. New episodes will drop the first Monday of every month with the host, Michael Bailey, that's me, that's the Bailey of Bailey's Batman podcast, going through the Batman media that I've consumed in the previous month. Comics, movies, novels, audio dramas, music, everything Batman related is on the table. It's one part commentary show, one part reading journal, and three parts personal journey of both discovery and rediscovery as I head back to Gotham City to get reacquainted with a character that was my absolute favorite until a certain Man of Steel took over that spot. Bailey's Batman Podcast. It's back. For reals. I'm not just doing this to mess with Professor Alan Middleton. Promise.
Imagine a podcast that celebrates the things we love. Why spend time being so angry and cynical about our fandoms? Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for a show where we're just trying to be happy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast. Our discussions focus on a variety of geeky subjects that we're passionate about. While the topics will be ever-changing, our focus will be on science fiction, comic books, what it means to be a geek in this world, and other nostalgia-fueled ideas. Life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. All right, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we do have Doug back with us. Doug, thank you so much for coming and hanging out and being on this episode. It's always a blast to catch up with you, my friend. I really appreciate
it. Shag.
Oh, you're too kind, and you need to set your standards higher. But why don't you tell the listeners at home where they can find more of you on the interwebs?
Oh, on the interwebs, I am astonishingly homeless right now. The sites I've written for, I am no longer writing for, and occasionally I'll pop up on my own Instagram, which I got to be honest with you, I don't even remember what the handle is, but I'll put a sketch or a photo from my backyard treehouse up there, and I really don't have a whole lot going on in the comic review or podcast realm right now. That said, I do kind of regularly contribute to Back Issue Magazine, and the most recent contribution showed up in Back Issue number 165, and then I've also got some things coming up in Issue 172, Shag. Given that your handle is Firestorm Fan, I'm going to say you're going to want to grab a copy of this one, and no, it's not about Firestorm.
Excellent.
And then also 175, which, listeners, Hawk Girl's on the cover of that one. Do the math.
Well, those are awesome. And Back Issue Magazine is such an amazing magazine. And I appreciate the heads up on those issues. I think I already have an idea what 172 might be about. So I definitely will be sure to get a copy. So thank you again, Doug, for doing this. It's been an absolute blast.
Thank you, Shag. It's been a pleasure to catch up with you again. I know we do this every so often, but every time it just feels like we're falling right back into a good old friendly conversation.
Absolutely true. All right. Well, that is going to do it, folks. Come back next episode when we present a special spotlight episode on a specific JSA character. And I'll be joined by a fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Doug.
And we're asking you to join the fight
for justice.